Happens Today on Midlands 103.
Hello and good morning. David Hollywood here, sitting in for Will. Welcome to Monday. I'm going to try and insist on meeting the start of the week with some vigour. You never know. It may help. How was your weekend? Was it a stay-in weekend or were you out and about? It certainly feels milder for it over the course of the last few days. I was able to bring my daughter to the skate park in Tullamore for the first time this year. The ramps were finally not soaking. We have a very important question to begin the show, I think. Pancake Tuesday is tomorrow. Am I right in saying that? It is indeed. Yeah, Pancake Tuesday is tomorrow. I want to know if you come from one of these like thick pancake houses or a crepe pancake house. I think people probably have very serious feelings on this. I certainly do. And that is lemon sugar on a wafer thin crepe, please. You can text or WhatsApp on 083 3010 103. Let's catch up on this morning's news and see what's in the papers today. Cost of living packages, of course, the announcements are in store for us tomorrow. And the prospect is that the €200 electricity credit seems to be unlikely to be kept on. How important was it to you? I know for a lot of people, it was the difference between making it through Christmas, making it through the winter and more serious consequences. Beyond that, they're looking at the hospitality sector may lose out on the lower VAT rate. Elsewhere, there's likely we could see petrol and diesel excise rates, the reductions there being reversed. What exactly is in store? Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, Taoiseach Micheál Martin, Green Party leader Eamon Ryan and other senior ministers are meeting today and they're going to finalise the cost of living measures ahead of that tomorrow. You can read about it in the Irish Times. Cormac Quinn is covering all the details there. But what supports need to stay from your perspective? We'd love to hear from you on that one. In the Irish Independent, they have revealed, I don't know how much of it is a reveal it is, the press release goes out to everybody. Pinergy got to the finish line first in terms of, instead of increasing the energy prices or the electricity rates that they charge, they are bringing it down, which is interesting because they were the last ones to bring them up. They increased it by 18% just a month or two ago, and they've they're to be reduced by 7.1%. Is this the sign of things to come? Is it the sun dawning on the horizon, or have we got more issues? Because ultimately, Russia and Ukraine are still in the midst of a war, and the energy markets, you'd have to say, are volatile at least. But they're heading in the right direction for the first time in a long time, which is obviously of huge reassurance to people listening in the Midlands today, especially off the basis that we've just said the electricity credit isn't likely to continue. Well, maybe the electricity providers who managed to hook up power to our homes will do the decent thing there and be able to pass on the savings, because at wholesale they are being charged less. Elsewhere, bad news being reported. The next global pandemic is inching closer. That's according to Dr. Mirish Houston, who says the latest evolution of bird flu raises serious concerns, and it's time to start testing and sequencing samples, which may sound alarmist, but ultimately we lacked that kind of reactive positioning when it came to COVID-19, which still remains a public health issue of international concern for the World Health Organization. They're waiting for signs to see if it will become a seasonal virus. And at the moment, their biggest concern casting forward into the future is a more familiar foe, and that's a bird flu, an influenza A virus first emerging in 1996. Since then, through various stages, it's decimated poultry and wild bird populations around the world. But now the H5N1 virus is spreading to mammals. It's becoming highly pathogenic and has a propensity to jump to humans with a high mortality rate. If you're of a mind, you can catch up on that one in the Irish Times as well. That's Dr. Mirish Houston. In the Indo, Holly Cairns is in a bit of bother. She's been questioned by the state watchdog over donations. The Social Democrats TD appears to have been given a donation over the legal limit. She says that the single payment came from two different people, so it wasn't necessary to declare it. Her party has accused Fine Gael's Pascal Donoghue of reverse engineering his donations to stay within the law. Is Miss Holly Cairns doing likewise? She says she knows the identity of the donors who gave money to her, who are listed as anonymous on an online donations website. She is, of course, a Cork Southwest TD, and she won in a Fine Gael heartland in the general election of 2020. That was a huge upset of the odds in that instance. And she will be doing well to find herself back in situ next time round. Not for anything to do with her track record and public representation, but simply because of the constituency that she's in. It is very challenging to beat the likes of Fine Gael in Cork South West. But she has had questions to answer in relation to donations, campaign donations. It seems to be a bit of a holding pattern or a repeat issue. Our public representatives are still getting themselves into difficulty in that respect. Fionnán Sheehan has written up report up on Social Democrats TD Holly Cairns in the Irish Independent. Staying with the Indo, Nicola Bully's partner, this is terribly sad, of course, isn't it? Tells of the agony after a body has been found in the river, while searching for Nicola Bully, the lady who was mother of two who was who has been missing. She was walking her dog. She was found yesterday morning about a mile from where she was last seen, the 45-year-old. She was last seen walking her dog in St. Michael's on the Wire, or the Weir, I should say, after dropping her daughters, who were just 6 and 9 years old, at school. In a message to Sky News, her partner, Paul Ansell, said he has no words right now, just agony. We're all together and we have to be strong. So your heart breaks for that family. And it looks like at least they will get that closure, because obviously when it comes to tragic missing person cases, oftentimes I think the worst scenario is that there's no resolution and families are left ultimately being told, maybe by the emergency services or those investigating the case, to move on at some juncture. But I don't think it's ever possible, is it, until you at least know for sure what's happened. I know in a personal position, you wouldn't let go. Simple as that. The Journal.ie reporting on Facebook and Instagram. They've gone the way of Twitter, which seems like an interesting decision. Elon Musk has certainly made the world of social media a more colourful place to live. Facebook and Instagram are introducing paid verification. Okay, I do know why they're doing it. They're going to get paid. This is the reason. The monthly subscription will cost the equivalent of €11.20. It's unclear when the feature will be introduced in Ireland. It's also unclear to me as to what benefits there are from verification. They say verifying it gets you the blue badge. You get extra you're protected from impersonations against accounts claiming to be you. I suppose you just have to be over a certain threshold of recognisability to be a target of that kind of manipulation. So most of us don't need to worry about whether or not Facebook or Instagram are going down the verification route, but the journal.ie are telling us that they are indeed doing that. And of course, these social media platforms have not been in the headlines for good reasons in terms of the tech sector industry has seen many jobs go over the course of the last few months. And the worst part of it, I suppose, is that they've been over hiring. So they got their forecasts wrong. And ultimately, those are real people that they've kind of brought in and chucked out. I don't know if it's first in, first out kind of a policy, but certainly the way they've managed their resources, they'll reflect on that with a bit of regret, you'd sense. And let's have a look at the BAFTAs. And this film, Banshees of Inisherin, is starting to gather a bit of Oscar momentum, is it not? It picked up 4 awards at the BAFTAs last night. Colin Farrell was beaten to the Best Actor gone, but Kerry Condon and Barry Keoghan won supporting awards for actress and actor. They were both phenomenal in the film, it has to be said. And Martin McDonagh takes Best British Film and Screenplay. And obviously the Banshees of Inisherin shot in Ireland with lots of Irish talent, but Martin McDonagh, I think it's fair to say, is the most British element of the production. but he does have a propensity for making well-crafted Irish-centric films. They won 4 BAFTAs. They won, as I said, for the Supporting Actress and Actor Awards. That's Kerry Condon from Tipperary, Barry Keoghan, of course, from Dublin. Best British Film and Best Original Screenplay. And Austin Butler beat Colin Farrell to the Best Actor Award for his turn in Elvis. Which I didn't go see. I went to see Top Gun that night in the cinema, and to this day I totally and utterly regret it. It's not a bad film, Top Gun, but this Elvis thing apparently was quite good, so I have to catch up with that, obviously. That is the in the Irish Times, Donald Clark. Donald Clark's always good, actually, in terms of writing up the movies. The ceremony itself, he said, it was occasionally ramshackle but glossy. I don't know how that's possible. What I would say is I really enjoyed Richard E. Grant and Alison Hammond as presenters. I was speaking about that with my partner last night when we were watching it, and we were thinking, we were talking about how, yeah, you're going to get some sort of comedian, a controversialist at the Oscars, whereas Richard Grant and Alison Hammond, they just presented a good show. They were really well-natured, so that was good to see as well. Cavan, most romantic county, as it led the way in the rise on Valentine's Day gift spending. This is our final news piece for the moment in terms of what's in the papers, and romance very much not dead in Cavan. They spent, this is ridiculous, 126% more on romantic items. Okay, I've asked you for your perspectives on pancakes, which is coming up tomorrow, and I'll get on to that shortly. The responses are coming in as well. I would also like to hear from you on what you did in and around Valentine's Day. Did you spend more than last year? Because Bank of Ireland's Valentine's Day spending analysis shows that, yes, 126% more in Cavan. Second on the list was Offaly. However, it was 49%, significantly lower. And the spending hikes were across a range of romantic gifts, spa breaks, grooming and beauty, jewellery, chocolates, perfume and flowers. All very nice things, in fairness, and worth, on occasion, indulging on and spending on. So did you increase your spend this year? People in Offaly certainly did, nearly by to the tune of 50%. Wicklow, Roscommon and Sligo also went up. There was those who cut back, though. Waterford, Leitrim, Kildare, Kerry and Kilkenny. I don't know what that tells us about modern day life, or indeed the counties from which you see that those statistics. But as things stand, maybe we're becoming a bit more comfortable in what we're spending. Let us know how you spent and what you spent on Valentine's Day. 083 30 10 103. That's a text or WhatsApp. Still to come this morning, it's a jam-packed show. You'll be hearing from the local councillor who received abuse and death threats over her comments on social housing. Have you a loved one experiencing dementia or Alzheimer's? Stick around this morning because we'll be talking to an expert on that. Maybe you were in Mullingar yesterday, or you went down to Carlow. Westmeath hosted Offaly and Laois were at Netwatch Cullen Park, and that was all Allianz Football League action. The ladies were in Lidl National Football League action as well. It was a mixed bag for all the Midlands counties. Your Monday Sports Review is at 11:20, and there's loads more besides. Now, you're very welcome back to the show. I'm very glad to say joining me now is Independent TD for Kildare South, Cathal Berry. Cathal, how are you keeping?
Good morning, David. Happy Monday.
Thank you. Thank you. Exactly. I'm trying to tell people this morning. Now, happy Monday indeed. That being said, we're specifically looking at an issue I know that's close to your heart, which is the story regarding the veterans charity, Ogla na Seanta na hÉireann. First of all, I suppose, why don't you explain to our listeners what it is that the group does for Irish veterans?
Yeah, so the ONE is a fantastic organisation. Really, there's 140,000 Defence Force veterans in Ireland at the moment. So these are 140,000 people who used to serve in our Defence Forces, but now they're veterans. They've transitioned to civilian life. And, you know, statistically, a smaller percentage of those will find that transition a bit difficult. That's where the ONE really kicks in. They provide homeless hostels and support and counselling services for veterans who have fallen on hard times, or who just need a little bit of extra support to make the transition to civilian life.
And according to the service, they're seeing a lot more members using the service. And one house in particular said that they went from 27 up to 70 currently living in that house. So why is the situation getting worse?
Well, first of all, the number of veterans are increasing because a lot of people are leaving the Defence Forces. But the cost of living crisis is definitely having an effect. A lot of marital and relationship breakdown as well. So you have a lot of single men who will be looking for accommodation. And that's really where O&E really come into their own, because they do provide that hostel type accommodation in Dublin, in Cove, in Athlone and Letterkenny, which really helps out these people who are experiencing some difficulties.
So that we have the cost of living issue. We have, as you say, kind of an issue with just there being more veterans in the first place. So what are the steps that need to be taken to ensure that the servicemen and women who've that they continue to have an independent life, and that they can live in this country with the comfort in their mind that they can have a home as well? I imagine like that's a very broad question, but from your perspective, what would you call on to address this issue at the moment?
Yes. Yeah, so first of all, of the 140,000 veterans out there, the vast majority made the transition very, very successfully. But for the small subset that need additional support, really it's housing is number one. Secondly, it's medical support. And thirdly, it's counselling services. Because we all know from a homelessness point of view, it's quite a complex phenomenon. There's a lot of factors at play. So those three things, housing, medical support and counselling service would certainly be a great help, Def.
And as you say there, in terms of the counselling support, one of the questions or the issues we have here is the veterans being institutionalised over a period of time. Is there anything the Defence Forces can do to mitigate against this while people are serving?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this used to be an issue in decades past. I mean, back in the 60s and 70s, you might have had people joining the Defence Force at 16 years of age. They might have come from disadvantaged backgrounds. They might have come from poor social circumstances. And if you joined at 16 and served until 60, making the transition from military life into civilian life might be a bit more difficult. It's not really a major issue at the moment for people who join currently, because they join with greater educational standards. They spend less time in the Defence Forces, and that transition isn't as hard. But I suppose reaching back from a legacy point of view is the people who did join in the 60s and 70s at a very young age, the Defence Forces could make things a bit more easier from a retirement preparation point of view. Now, they do run a 3-day course, which is very, very good, but you could expand that to perhaps a week long and provide a bit more briefs in relation to social services, social supports, homeless supports, etc., etc. So I think the Defence Forces could do a small bit more, particularly for people who are approaching the age of 60 and would have joined at a very early age.
You were in contact with the Taoiseach recently about this issue. What was the nature of your discussions with Micheál Martin?
Yeah, the Taoiseach is actually Minister for Defence as well, which is, I guess, fortuitous, yeah, really, because he's quite a lot of influence. But at Leaders' Questions last week in the Dáil Chamber, he basically gave a commitment to renovate a lot of housing in the Curragh camp. So there's 62 vacant and semi-derelict houses that are publicly owned. These are family homes in the Curragh camp, which is incredible, really, when you consider we've been in the midst of a housing crisis for a number of years now at this stage. But basically, he pretty much on the hoof decided to change the Department of Defence policy in relation to the housing. So previously they were trying to wind down the housing supports available for troops and their families, but basically he decided on his feet in the Dáil Chamber to alter that policy with immediate effect, and he's having a meeting this week with his officials and to renovate those 62 houses and make them available to military families, which is a very, very positive step.
That must be relatively unusual in politics to see that kind of ability to turn on a dime, as it were, and if one hears a case being made in a way that's compelling enough to change what is a substantive perspective.
Yeah, very rare, but very, very positive. And I think it probably shows that the cross-party support for it as well. In fairness to my other colleagues in Kildare South constituency, so Martin Hayden, Seán Fhreal, Fiona Loughlin, Mark Wall in particular as well of the Labour Party, they've been constantly advocating for this for a number of years. And it's good that, I mean, I agree that the Defence of the Nation should be an apolitical, non-party political process. And when you have a lot of moderate, experienced politicians who have the best intentions of the public at heart, advocating for a particular thing, sometimes we get some successes. And last week was a classic example of that.
Well, that is good to hear in that respect. And I know that the houses that ONE or Ogilvy Náisiúnta na hÉireann run are getting fuller as time goes on. In Athlone and Cove, they're being reported as being completely full at the moment. In Letterkenny, they're at 80% capacity. In Dublin, about three quarters full or a bit less than that. So kind of time is of the essence. There's a fundraiser launched on Dublin's Grafton Street as well for the group as well. So I imagine you would be compelling our listeners or certainly asking them if they're of a mind to do what they could to donate to a group like ONE.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, a very worthy cause. And if anybody could make a donation, that's if they're in a position to do so, then it would be hugely appreciated if possible.
Well, I suppose if there ever was a good cause in that respect, it's to a group of people who've committed a career or a lifetime in service to the state. And it's always troubling to hear of people moving towards difficult times in that respect. And as you say, it's because of a very complex sequence of issues, not just one particular issue. So it's a story that probably has further developments to come. But for the 140,000 veterans in the country, hopefully progress will be coming shortly. Cathal Berry, thank you very much for coming in to us this morning.
A pleasure, David. Take care.
We will be looking forward next to a story regarding people in the Midlands and apparently have the least amount of disposable income in the country. So that one, I'm looking forward to get into our discussion with a statistician from the CSO on that basis. And we have a great competition to get involved in today and throughout the week, courtesy of Tullamore Court Brasserie. They've got new menus and new seasonal dishes to look forward to. The competition itself gives listeners an opportunity to win a three-course meal for two people. We're giving away one each day this week. One lucky person will be upgraded at the end of the week to a three-course meal for four people, including a house, a bottle of wine. To enter, get onto midlands103.com, the win section of the website, or get to it through Facebook and fill in the form to be in with a chance to win that competition. As I said, next up, we will be talking statistics, specifically though, disposable income and how people in the Midlands seem to be coming in at the lower end of that scale. And Imelda has messaged in to say she's with me on the thin pancake front. I have to get the stuff organised for tomorrow morning, come to think of it, or tomorrow afternoon more likely. Also, she actually made a very good point, Imelda, so thanks for messaging in to us, that while the struggles that we've had with energy and the cost of electricity have been gross and unfair and awful, also it's been educational for a lot of people who didn't have to learn how to be conservative with their energy. You know, I think a certain generation knew how to handle things in terms of keeping heat in the home and being careful with that immersion, whereas a new generation have unfortunately had to learn that lesson, but it could be valuable going forward. Speaking of value, we've an interesting question here, and that question is, what is the story with disposable income? Why are people in the Midlands the grouping in the CSO's research that has the least? I'm very glad to say that statistician with the CSO, Aoife Crowe, joins me to have a look at this particular issue. Aoife, how are you keeping today?
Hi, Ronan. How are things? I'm good. Cheers. Thank you.
Very good. Let's have a look at the top line question first and foremost, so myself and our listeners can know what we're dealing with. Can you explain to us what disposable income means and how is one's disposable income defined?
So disposable income is basically the household income that we calculate in the CSO. So it is an estimate, but it is largely driven by wages and salaries. So we would take wages and salaries for people who are employed. We would add on, say, self-employed income. We actually add on, say, rent. So if you pay rent, you pay it to a private landlord generally. And that would then be included in self-employed income. Things like income or interest and dividends is added on. We would add on then something called social transfers. So that would be any type of a benefit you would receive from the state. So for these figures for 2020, that would come into play more with the pandemic unemployment payments, the temporary wage subsidy scheme, things like that. and then to arrive then at the disposable income, we just minus off taxes. So that's kind of the broad manner in how we calculate disposable income.
Okay, that gives us a good perspective on what we're dealing with here. Then now, as you just mentioned yourself there, actually, that there were pandemic unemployment payments involved over the period that this research was done, because it was based on data from 2020. What other effects did the pandemic have on the work involved, or did it affect the information itself?
So like you would see, like you said there, the pandemic unemployment, different type of government, benefits coming into play, that kind of like that would have been factored in then to disposable income. Employment figures obviously would have taken a toll there as well. So we would have seen slight decreases in employment then just coming into 2020 across all regions. So while there were decreases across all areas, the decreases were bigger in urban areas, bigger in areas that have a bigger dependency on, say, like the service industry. But like there wouldn't have been a big enough difference to throw off overall trends that we have been seeing in employment for the past 10 years or so.
No, that seems consistent, doesn't it? Like the gap between counties with the highest and the lowest, has that gap gotten bigger or is it contracting? And what has been the long term or the medium term trend?
So what we do see is that disposable income across all regions is rising. And the same in the Midlands. The Midlands has risen from about €16,000 per person in 2014 up to about €19,000 in 2020. There's a 10% rise there from 2019 to 2020, which is quite considerable. But when we actually compare that then against urban areas, against Dublin, the rates of increase between rural and urban areas is disproportionate as well. So then when we go to look at, say, the difference between, the lowest earning counties versus the highest earning counties, there is a trend whereby that gap does seem to be getting bigger year on year. So, and that is what we observed in for 2020 as well. I think that gap was in around €9,000 between, say, income per person in Donegal, which ranked as the lowest, and income per person in Dublin.
Then from year to year, how much do these figures change generally? What's the direction of travel like for the Midlands relative to the rest of the country? I know it's gone from 16 to 19, as you said there, but in terms of in relation to counties around it, and obviously, as you say, certain counties are harder to compare to others.
Exactly, yeah. So like when we do say the Midlands, we are talking about counties Westmeath, Leash, Offaly and Longford. So within those four counties, Westmeath does come out on top, and then that would be followed by Leash, then Longford and Offaly, which would be very much on a par with each other. So like while we don't really look at the intra-county kind of breakdowns, inside counties, we can say that Athlone is probably a big benefit into Westmeath, Portlaoise a big benefit into Leash as well. So we do see like the income rising in each of these counties year on year as well. We see maybe about €500 to about €1,000 increase year on year.
Okay, and then the work and the report suggests that at the end of the day, employees they're magnetically attracted to the large population centres like Dublin. I mean, we had, am I right in saying a third of all employees in the country worked in Dublin in 2020?
Yeah, exactly. Like that is what our figures were showing. So Dublin is a big outlier in terms of employment and then disposable income. So when disposable income is so heavily dependent on obviously wages and salaries, cities or urban areas that have obviously high unemployment will then you will see that in disposable income. After that, then you would have Cork. I think it's about 12% of all workers in the state reside then in Cork as well. So, like, cities really bolster a region's economy. And you can see that in the southwest with Cork, in the mid-east with Dublin, the mid-west with Limerick, and then in the west as well with Galway. So I suppose that is a disadvantage for areas like the Midlands and like the border areas, where there isn't necessarily that proximity to a city. And cities will kind of, attract in more profitable sectors, sectors like IT in Dublin or industry in the southwest. That provide that kind of high-paying employment as well. That brings up an overall, the region's disposable income.
Well, Aoife, I mean, it seems like a very complex problem to unravel in terms of having an even spread of disposable income in this country. And as you say there, obviously, population centres, I mean, decentralisation has been a buzzword for a very long time, but it sounds like that might be something to look at with a renewed focus. For the moment, though, Aoife Crowe, statistician with the Central Statistics Office, thanks very much for taking the time to talk us through disposable income this morning.
No worries. Thank you very much now.
Aoife Crowe, very good there to talk us through that. We are coming up on time to go to the news. Just got some good news for you, and that is we're going to have a chef on Midlands today, tomorrow. But that's not the day I'm doing this, so this is really actually not good news from my perspective. Anyway, you're going to be getting tips on how to make the perfect pancakes. And today I'm asking you, does anybody come from a household that goes for those thicker, fluffier ones? I certainly thought they were the business as a kid, but I think that was television. You're very welcome back to the show, and we have an interesting issue to address at this juncture. Firstly, I just want to circle back to a message we got in relation to the energy supports. This one comes from Duncan in Shinrone. He says that obviously rates like normal, he reckons, the cost and of gas and oil prices, but the government, they need to ensure that the customer-facing price comes back quickly, not in the next 3 months, as they go continue to talk about reductions taking time to filter through. And Duncan says a point which I think a lot of people might echo, is that it doesn't take long to hike the prices. It takes an awful lot of time to get them back down to where they might or they should be. Now, a Laois County councillor a Laois County councillor was sent a series of abusive messages, death threats, and this was all based on comments that she made in a monthly meeting of Laois County Council. I'm speaking, of course, of Fine Gael councillor Aisling Moore. And Aisling, thanks for taking the time to talk to us this morning. The last time we spoke, there was a controversy over the comments you made about social housing, and we can talk about the issue itself and the language we use about these issues, but first catch us up on how the fallout continued after that particular meeting of Laois County Council. I have Aisling, but I have not necessarily brought her over. 2 seconds now. Aisling, are you with me now?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. You heard my initial question. You can catch us up maybe on what happened after this meeting of Laois County Council, please.
Well, after the meeting, there was an article put up on Facebook, and basically they had taken the context, they'd taken what I had said out of context. And I thought that the headline was very kind of nearly aggressive, but the comments were very aggressive. I'd say 95% of them were very angry and personal. Even some people commented, you know, you're attacking this woman personally. And then there was another article put up, and 95% of those were positive. And then I went on to Pat Kenny, and since I've been on Pat Kenny, I have received hundreds of emails, phone calls, texts, WhatsApp, Messenger, all positive.
Okay, so
it's what people needed. They wanted help. And they wanted somebody to say it.
Okay, because the issue we're talking about here is social housing, and that how, for instance, a couple earnings just over 42,000 a year in combined salary can't get onto the social housing list. But obviously, they're not in a position with the current cost of living crisis to be able to afford to purchase their own home. So this, I suppose, is something that a lot of people can relate to.
Yeah, it is. And I think that they've moved the thresholds up. So, like a few months ago, you know, say three adults and four children, they had to be earning under 32,000 to be eligible for social housing. So they've brought the thresholds up to 42,000 now, which is still, I suppose, after tax, you're talking about €700 a week for seven people. That was fine a couple of years ago. With energy hikes and the cost of living, you couldn't pay it. Like, rent is between €1,400 and €2,000. You would literally pay your rent and that's it. You know, and I think something has to be done for people. You know, if you're earning 42,000 a year, you can get help. If you're earning 43,000 a year, which probably over the year is an extra 10 or 15 euros a week in your wage packet, you're entitled to no help, nothing.
Yeah, and we've heard loads over time immemorial regarding the squeezed middle, but it's become a real reality, if I could say that, in recent times. Aisling, the point you made about the system and the issue was that there's people abusing the system who don't intend on working a day in their life and they've never done so previous. And that was, I suppose, the tone of the language is what consequently led to a lot of people being upset by that. It's one thing being upset, but it's absolutely another thing altogether to go and manifest that upset by contacting you personally and sending you not constructive criticism, not a request, not any sort of engagement that you can use, but the opposite. It was abuse, and it went beyond that as well. Can you talk to us about the kind of messages you were getting?
Yeah, there were a few people had rang and were very irate when they kind of came on the phone. And I spoke to them and I said I did say it, and this is the context I said it in, and I explained to them. And kind of after speaking to them for a while, they came, you know, people kind of stood back and went, geez, you're right, you're actually right. Yeah, no, I thought you were talking about me, and, you know, I have a disability, or, you know, my wife is at home minding the kids and that sort of stuff. And I explained, that's not who I was talking about. I'm not talking about, you know, the couples where one stays at home to look after children because the childcare costs are too high. I'm not talking about a person on disability or a lone parent on their own and the cost of childcare is too high and they have no other option. I'm talking about people who make a decision not to go and work. And, like, I have had people who rang me to say, my daughter's 18 next week. I want her put on the housing list. And I said, oh, has she a disability? No. And I said, so what, you know, is there a reason why you want to put on the housing list? Because she's entitled, he said. You know, and that's what we have to change. And that whole system has to change and it has to be addressed.
Is that not the price we pay, though, for providing a social security net to all citizens in the country, regardless of race, creed, background, or... do you know what I'm saying, Aisling? Like, if you're going to provide safety and security for people, it can't be contingent on people who act in good faith. So unfortunately, there's always a certain percentage of people who are going to game the system. And the latest statistics...
abuse the system, yeah.
Absolutely. But the statistics indicate that it's a small percentage, and it always has been.
It's a small percentage, but there are a number of people in it, in those houses. And, like... you know, and I was saying that the council, instead of selling their stock, housing stock, that we should be holding on to our housing stock. And that if you are in a situation where you need help, that the government, you should be then, you're giving your house and you can stay in that. And if your situation changes and maybe you might be in a position now to look at buying a house, that the council should be trying to help you to get out of the house, get out of the social house and into, you know, your own house, buy your own house. You know, and there is money there. Like, we're just spending money after money, keeping people suppressed. We need to be letting people, you know, buy their own homes and help them to do so.
So those are the details of the discussion and the merits of the debate, and that's all fair enough. What about you personally, Aisling? How does it affect you to be on the receiving end of... like I said, not a kind of constructive engagement. And as you said, there are those who you took calls off who were angry initially, and when they understood where you're coming from, they realised that they were in broad agreement with you. What does it feel like personally, though, to be subjected to that kind of that irate anger? And I'm right in saying you did receive at least a death threat as well.
Yeah. Look, the way I look on it, I would think I'm fairly tough-skinned. But it does get in on you, I suppose, a little bit. And Fiona, my wife, was saying to me, you know, stop reading them. And I say, it doesn't bother me. I'm only just reading to see what they say. And she's like, it does, because it gets in on you. It will get in on you eventually. So I kind of had to stop reading some of them. But I have to say, after the Pat Kenny interview last week, the support was unbelievable. I never experienced anything like it. I'm overwhelmed. By it, to be honest.
Those are the two sides of the coin, I suppose, in that respect.
Yeah, completely. And you know, the fact that I said something that offended some people, I'm truly sorry for that. But I also said things that resonated with an awful lot of people, and they felt comfort in the fact that I had said it, and now it's out there. And now it is out there. So we need to act on it. And we need to act on it as quickly as we can. We need to be building houses. and that sort of stuff. You know, we need more solutions and we need things to happen quicker.
Well, the imperative is there, of course. We know we have our massive issues with housing. I wanted to ask you, I was speaking to your council colleague, Aidan Mullins, Sinn Féin councillor, of course. He described to me a council chambers where childish arguments are constantly breaking out. He also asserted that the treatment you've received from others, your council colleagues, has bordered on bullying. Would you say you've experienced bullying in the chambers, Aisling?
Well, what I'd say, David, is if I bring up a topic, and you know, we're democratically elected, and our job is to bring issues that people, if you have an issue and you ask me, I bring it up, and that's the way it is. And when you bring up something in the chamber, you're kind of shut down, and there is a cohort of there who, the minute I open my mouth, are shouting and roaring at me to stop.
Who's part of the cohort?
It's an instant thing. So you don't get to, and I can guarantee you, if there was live streaming, and these were one of the meetings, if there was live streaming, none of that would be going on. Because I'll bring up an issue that is in the public interest, and I'll get shut down. But if those meetings were live streamed, none of those councillors would shout at me. You know, they wouldn't come back at me and all of that, because what they'd be saying would be more kind of with the executives than with the public.
Yeah, and obviously if there's eyes on them, they will modify their behaviour in that respect. Would you ever consider changing the platform upon which you stand, i.e. you're a Fine Gael councillor? Is that something you see yourself being in for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, I do love politics. I've been involved in politics since I was a kid. I was canvassing and dropping leaflets, and you know, I always had a very good interest. I'm good on, you know, just statistics and that sort of thing.
What about the party itself, Fine Gael?
What about the party? Well, you know, I think when you're in a party, you shouldn't have to, I don't toe the line always, but I believe that Fine Gael would be the best party for me, as in it would have a lot of the stuff that I believe in, not everything. And I believe that when I do have an issue with something, I should be entitled to say it. Like, I've had the whip put on me on a couple of occasions in the group, which I broke because I did not agree with it. You know, and you're not supposed to do that, but they were put on me to stop me saying what I wanted to say rather than, you know, that was the reason they were put on me. So, yeah, I just think when you're in politics, you know, you have to be able, like, we should be allowed to voice our concerns and say what we believe.
Well, I don't think anybody listening here today would argue against that, Aisling, not in the slightest. My final question then is, you've been in this position since 2019. In those years you've been in representative politics, what have your interactions with the public been like? And what I'm asking here is, have they changed? A lot of people say that the pandemic has affected people's humour, mood and how they approach issues. And a lot of us feel that maybe we're a more emotive people. We're reacting quicker. Do you see any of that on the ground or in your interactions in your constituency?
You would. People are angrier. The problem is the cost of living has gone up. And, you know, if you can't put food on the table for the kids, or you have a child crying for a pair of runners that everyone else in the school has, it's very hard on parents. And I do think that, you know, people have been kind of nearly pushed out of jobs and into social welfare because that's the only thing that they can see. It's the only light at the end of the tunnel that they can see. You know, and so there are reasons there why people are angry and upset. Now, there is a very negative kind of far right wing at the moment. Coming in, they're against everybody, and that's terrible. Like, the protesting, even about Ukrainians and stuff like that. Like, we as a society, we have to protect people who are vulnerable, and that's it. You have to do that. And but I don't think we should be bringing in hundreds of thousands of people to the country and not look after them properly. You know, now we have a case where you've business people buying up old hotels and buildings and doing them up and they're housing them, and it's a money thing now. It should never be about money. Like, the government should have houses available when the people come in that they're put into them. They get their PPS numbers and then they're able to work, and then, you know, they head off. They stay there for 3 months in this direct provision or whatever, or an area, and then after a couple of months they have their PPS number, they can work, and then, like all of us, you know, if you want to work and rent a house or anything like that. But that's what we should be doing. Instead of keeping people confined, putting them into housing and leaving them there, you know, people who would have worked before and coming over not allowed to work, stuff like that.
Give people a fair chance.
We need to start giving people a fair chance.
Yeah, well, and look, I mean, I suppose the bright side to the downside of these anti-asylum seeker protests has been the solidarity march that took place in Dublin. I believe hundreds of thousands involved in that, or was it 50,000? I'll double check the figures there and get back to our listeners. But Aisling, for the moment, I appreciate you coming on and talking to us about the interactions with the public that you've had, and hopefully they are in the future a lot more on the merits of the issues as opposed to personal or anything along those lines. Thanks for taking the time.
No problem. In general, people are they're lovely to deal with. People kind of, you know, Irish people are we're a friendly nature anyway, you know, and I find it's really a cup of tea and a conversation, you know. People are very nice. It's just that there is an angry element in there now at the moment. That's all.
Well, it's certainly, no public representative deserves to get what you got in that instance. So the best of luck in the future. Thank you, Aisling. That was Aisling Moran, Laois County Councillor with Fianna Gael. And shortly enough this morning, we're going to be able to look at the issue of dementia and Alzheimer's. It is such a difficult topic to deal with, and it's quite a stigmatised issue. Later on, we will be hearing from Eamon Ryan, who was in Tullamore last week announcing Ireland's rural mobility plan. Why hasn't rural Ireland been connected thus far is a question he was asked on that occasion, and what is the reason why rural communities should be linked together. We're going to hear from the Green Party leader later on this morning. As I said, next up we're going to be talking to an expert in the realm of dementia and Alzheimer's, and you also have, of course, a great opportunity to win a big competition, which I'll fill you in on next. Hilda from Sinn Raon has been in touch in relation to our discussion about those who might be gaming the system. She agrees that there's always a small number of individuals exploiting the system, but it's larger corporations, Hilda says, that are fleecing everyone in a state-sanctioned fashion, and that again touches on the energy credits price cap question. If you want to get your thoughts in to us, don't hesitate to shoot that message 083 3010 103 on Midlands Today. Very good morning to you. I hope you had a good weekend. Thanks to everybody who's writing in. Thanks to everybody who's listening this morning. If you want to win an opportunity for a 3-course meal for two people, we're giving away one every day this week. And then at the end of the week, one of those winners is going to be a winner twice over, because they're going to get a 3-course meal for four people, including a bottle of the house vino as well. That's all courtesy of Tullamore Court Brasserie. You can get into the competition on midlands103.com, the win section of the website, or you can get to it through our social platforms, Facebook. Fill in the form there to be in with a chance to win. That is the competition that we have, and we're going to have it throughout the week. We can now look at a particularly affecting issue, I think, for many people, and that is the issue of Alzheimer's and dementia. I think we all collectively winced when we saw that Bruce Willis, his diagnosis from aphasia has moved on to dementia, and we know that it's a disease that carries with it a great stigma. It's probably something Alice Farrell, advanced nurse practitioner of Midlands Regional Hospital Tullamore, with a specialty in older people. This is probably something that we have to get better at talking about, isn't it?
Good morning. Yes, I think so, and I think, you know, we're probably seeing a bigger prevalence than we ever did, particularly because people are living longer, and it seems like it's more common in society. Yeah.
So talking about it raises awareness, and that's one thing. And I think many of us have heard the refrain in relation to mental health about this, that, you know, enough awareness can be raised, but then resources needs to be raised in that respect. Where are we in Ireland and in the Midlands with our treatment options on dementia and Alzheimer's? Like, is it well funded enough?
Well, I suppose in the acute hospital services, they all have a clinical nurse specialist. I know in Tullamore we have a couple of memory clinics, and we have geriatricians who are managing it. So, you know, the diagnosis side is probably fairly well covered. In terms of support, we have, you know, the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland, who are doing brilliant work. And also, I suppose, here in Laois and Offaly and Longford and Westmead, we have a dementia advisor in both of those areas. So there is a good deal of support. The primary care that's always been there, they are obviously a resource, like GPs, public health nurse, and the community care side of things. I suppose when it comes to care at home, we might be lacking a little bit there, and that's a, you know, that's a huge problem in terms of people being able to stay in their own homes, because there isn't a huge deal of, a huge amount of practical support.
No, and that's when it really does become a huge practical challenge. What are the things that we should look out for if either people listening are in the age bracket where this can occur, or indeed if there is adults with parents who are entering into that age bracket? Like, what age does it commonly kick in the first place? What kind of symptoms do we talk about?
Well, I suppose, you know, it is largely a disease of older people, but younger people can be affected too. It's important to say that. And Bruce Willis is only 67, I think. But, you know, I suppose the majority of people we would see would probably be over 65 or maybe over 70, or indeed older than that. In terms of things to look out for, I suppose, you know, everyone will say, oh, you know, forgetting. That's probably one of the first things, and not remembering things. But I suppose it's important to say it's not the normal memory loss, like, you know, somebody's name or where you left your keys or what you went into the kitchen for. It's not those kinds of things. It's probably more significant than that. Things like, you know, remembering, not remembering recent events, for example, or who came to visit you yesterday, or, you know, particularly recent events in your family or things that you've done. There can also be, like Bruce Willis, I suppose, there can also be language and word-finding difficulties that people might experience. It can be changes in mood and behaviour. People might become confused in even in familiar surroundings, or there can also be like poor concentration when you're reading a book, for example. You might not remember the beginning when you get to the end, or watching television, not being able to concentrate on a programme or a plot of a film. Sometimes people experience problems with managing money, paying bills, and just generally organising themselves, things that they would have done easily in the past.
You mentioned there one of the symptoms in relation to mood and behaviour, and there we're talking about feelings, and you mentioned confusion, but what are the kind of feelings that could actually be identified as a symptom? Because that's a very, I suppose, internal thing that a lot of us mightn't see on the outside, but maybe somebody listening has noticed they're feeling a certain way.
I suppose things like some people experience depression in the early stages of dementia, and their mood may be affected by that. And that's maybe a realisation, a small realisation, that maybe this is what they have or this is what they're experiencing. There can be sadness, there can be loneliness. People can withdraw from their normal life if they feel that they have a memory problem, or if they're not able to interact the way that they used to, or converse or keep up with the conversation, or, you know, I suppose there's a fear as well. Fear is probably another feeling that people may experience. Fear for the future, and fear how the disease will develop and how it will affect the people around them.
And when it does start, or when it is happening and maybe a diagnosis has been confirmed, what are the steps then that a family can take if it is a situation maybe where a mom or a dad or both of them are living independently at that time, but it looks like that might not be the case? What's the kind of process a family has to go through then?
I suppose everybody is different, and some people may stay at the point that they're at and may still be fairly highly functioning or functioning enough to be able to need a minimal level of support. Other people won't be as lucky as that. I think it's important to tell friends and family that this is what you have, so that they're in a position to support you. I think there's practical things too, like adaptations to your home and maintaining your personal safety. There are things like, you know, calendars and cues in the home to kind of keep people on track, routines, days of the week. Little things like that will help people to remain independent. What else? I suppose in the extreme, and people need to think about planning for the future, or maybe planning for a point where they may not be able to make decisions for themselves, and making arrangements for that with their family members so that they don't run into trouble, you know, with money and succession and those kinds of things. They should be in order, really.
Yeah, it's certainly, it takes a lot of work to be able to make it work if that's what a family is facing. And it takes a lot of bravery from everybody involved. And I suppose all we can hope for is that research and treatment improves over the years, because as you say, the population, we're just going to have more and more people in that age bracket where it might occur. For the moment, though, Alice, thank you very much for taking the time to talk us through that today. That's Alice Farrell, Advanced Nurse Practitioner in Tullamore Hospital. Thanks again, Alice.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Alice talking about dementia, which Bruce Willis is being diagnosed with. And, I suppose I'd put the shed out. What are your memories of Bruce Willis's acting career? What a phenomenal career he had. Frontotemporal dementia is what he has now. He will, his acting career has finished. I think aphasia did that for him in any case. But he was certainly a force of a personality in that respect. Next up, we're going to be talking about the BAFTAs and Irish success. Now, I was watching bits, snippets, clips and moments from the BAFTAs over the course of the weekend. There was great success for the Banshees of Inisherin, which has really gone on to massive success, certainly on that awards circuit, but they also nailed it in terms of the critics at the time of the cinema release as well. Tom Dowling joins me to talk about the BAFTAs. Tom, first off, let's deal with the headlines here. What did the Banshees of Inisherin pick up at the BAFTAs?
Good morning, David. Yeah, so I picked up four awards. So the Best Supporting Actor, the Best Supporting Actress, Best British Film, which is probably one that people would wonder, but the funding comes from Channel 4, and the Best Screenplay.
So let's talk about the acting performances here, because I think they've been acknowledged as being standout from Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell. But of course, the award winners, of course, at the BAFTAs were the two support actors. Talk to us about their performances.
Yeah, well, Barry Keoghan, I mean, I think is one that people have been watching for a while. Barry Keoghan's rise in terms of his acting career has been something that's been growing from production to production, you know. So it wasn't a surprise to see that Barry's talent was rewarded last night. Kerry has been around quite a while now. She started out on Angela's Ashes with Alan Parker, as she mentioned last night, and she's been working a little bit under the radar in LA on productions, but she's also done a lot of work with Martin, as she outlined last night, and she does a lot of work in theatre as well. So, yeah, so I'm delighted for Kerry. She's a really nice person. Delighted for your winning that award last night.
Yeah, she gave a lovely speech. Great story from her perspective, and of course Barry Keoghan's got his own story in and of itself, which I suppose we should touch on. I don't want to make too much of it, because I think oftentimes we can end up almost fetishizing someone's difficult background when it comes to success. But he's come from the foster system in Ireland, as far as I understand, and he tends to be standing up and speaking up for people from that system as well.
Yeah, he comes from a foster home. I think that's no surprise. He mentions that in a lot of articles and interviews that he talks about. And he came from the inner city in Dublin, a really tough part of town. So it's great to see that Barry has come through a very difficult childhood for him to be where he is today. And it's a credit to the people who supported him in those foster homes as well that he is where he is today.
How much of an indicator are the BAFTAs for the Oscars? Or is it more the Globes? Or is it the Screen and Actors Guild? Which informs what? And you know, how likely is the Banshees of Inisherin, from a parochial sense, of course, and on Colin Keoghan, they look well positioned heading into the Oscars?
Well, if I knew the answer to that question, I'd be putting money down in the bookie office now, so... it's anybody's guess. So yes, they're in with a good shot, but the Oscars are an award unto themselves, so who knows, it's anybody's game, really.
And in terms of the BAFTA, the ceremony itself and the institution that it is, what did you make of the production this weekend for this year's renewal of it?
I think it was a great production. It was good to see such a diversity and variety of talent on display. And I really like to see that Sandy Powell got the merit for her costume design, the first person to ever get it from costume. And Sandy has done fabulous shows and fabulous costumes all over the world. So good to see that happening.
And then just a final question on the standard of this year's, I suppose, award season movies. They naturally get very much celebrated at this time of year, but what have you made about the overall quality, let's say?
I think the quality was very good. I mean, there was a wide variety of production values, production budgets. So you had productions like Avatar was in there. You had Maverick, Top Gun was in there. So, you know, you had a range of different productions, a range of different talents, different perspectives, different cultures. And again, on Colleen Quinn being in the mix there as well. And there's no doubt that All Quiet on the Western Front is a magnificent movie, you know, and it's something that everybody should see. So, yeah, I think the quality was very good. I think it was also poignant there last night to see that there were two Irish faces that came up in those people that we lost during the year. So both James Flynn and Tim Devine would have both worked on The Banshees of Inisherin. So unfortunately, we lost both earlier this year. So it was touching just to see those people being represented last night as well.
Tom Dowling, well said, and very hearty congratulations as well to Kerry Condon and Barry Keoghan, who picked up those awards. Thanks for talking to us this morning.
All right, take care. Thanks, David.
Yes, the news and the views that you can use. And Mary Mullingar has a view. She viewed Bruce Willis in The Whole Nine Yards, and there is a blast from the past. I think that was an absolutely daft comedy caper, wasn't it, with Chandler from Friends, going to call him, Matthew Perry? Matthew Perry, that takes me back anyway. That was the great thing about Bruce Willis as well, wasn't it? Aside from the fact that he had the action movie hero chops a la Die Hard and so on, he also had this other side to him where he could really deliver comedy. And again, it's one of those, it's just an affecting thing for someone of that great nostalgic feel to a lot of us to think that they're now in a position where they're unwell and they might be going through a very anxious moment in their lives. We're looking at an interesting story just before we break over to the Midlands 103 News Centre in relation to an autism unit that's opening up in a Midlands school today. It's been welcomed, but those involved in bringing it to Athlone Community College says there's still more to do. Those are the thoughts of Frankie Keena. It follows a year of campaigning by local parents and politicians to provide an adequate number of school places for autistic children. Mr. Keena says he wants to see more places for more children.
It's been a long road, and I'm just absolutely thrilled and delighted for the parents and for the students of this class. Just to say that the tank, in particular, there's a very kind of proactive group in the Athlone area called Autism Parents Athlone, which was led by Claire Early, and I believe they have renamed themselves now as Infinity Friends, I mean, to a recent launch. So really, really proactive group, I mean, in lobbying for kind of adequate school places for children who have autism, and also kind of for other needs as well. So I think to commend them, but can I just say, as I said, it's a long road, but it's my understanding this will be the first of four classes, because the Athlone Community College have plans to provide other classes as well in the future. We did a kind of enrollment was carried out there late last autumn, you know. So and so this class will take six students, and there is still a demand, which is something that needs to be addressed, and that's why I say Athlone Community College will have plans to provide extra classes also. But I have to put out the call to other secondary schools in the area to also, it would be great if they could step up as well and provide classes to meet the needs of children with autism and other needs as well. I think that's so important to get out there, and these children will be moving into the second level in probably next year and the years after, so we need to have second level places.
Yeah, a lot done and more to do for those in the Midlands trying to provide children with autism these autism units and generally services that are available. Very shortly we'll be hearing from Eamon Ryan, who's was in Tullamore launching the latest plan to connect rural communities through public transport. We'll also be looking back on the weekend sport. Good morning, and you're very welcome to your own personal Monday. I'm very glad to be alongside you for it. We've had loads of people reacting actually to the news that Bruce Willis's diagnosis of aphasia was moved to dementia, and it's obviously shone a big light on the issue itself. Lots of people getting in touch about their favourite Bruce Willis films and such an array of movies. And I mentioned that after Mary in Mullingar messaged in to mention The Whole Nine Yards, we then had someone follow up with Moonlighting, his TV series that really gave him that break. And again, it showed his range, because obviously with the likes of Armageddon and John McClane, Die Hard franchise, he had a certain type and he was often typecast, but he always showed that kind of comic twist. My personal favourite, I've decided, is and was The Fifth Element, which I may even indulge in this evening off the back of our discussions this morning. We're now looking at the fact that Eamon Ryan, the Green Party leader and Minister for Transport and Energy and Environment, was in Tullamore last week. He was launching new bus routes. Six new bus routes are coming to the Midlands. It's part of the Connecting Ireland Rural Mobility Plan, which will see 67 new or enhanced bus services. Some routes are already in operation, while others are still in planning stages. The services will connect more towns nationwide. Minister for Transport, as I said, Eamon Ryan, tells us why rural communities should be linked together.
Public transport routes which are going to be introduced this year. It's the Connecting Ireland service. It started last year and now we're really ramping it up. I just want to give you a couple of examples of the difference it's making, what's happening. We started last year, as I said, and what we found, every time we put in a good frequent public transport service, numbers take off. The A40 last year, from Banagher down to Tullamore, it went from about 100 customers a week to about 500 a week now. I was talking to Jerry Egan, the bus driver. He's saying it's all sorts of passengers. It's about a 50-kilometre trip, 8 stops along the way, €3 return, €1.50 if you're a student. Now that beats Banagher in my mind in terms of getting around this country and making it work. We already launched at the 823, going from Birr to Port Leash. That numbers were up to 1,100 a week. Real demand. And then new routes coming, the A50, going from Athlone down to Roscrea and on to Thurles. So these are all the routes that are about to be launched this year. It's a revolution in public transport in our country. And we're only warming up. The NTA managing the whole thing, local link bus companies, there's 14 of them, as well as Bus Éireann. They've real knowledge on the ground, they've real local expertise, connection to the community. It's a major step forward for rural public transport.
Minister Ryan says recruiting drivers is a challenge.
Just talking to the local link company here, they're saying, yeah, that's what we need, particularly younger people, to go into this profession. It's a good job. You get thanked every day along the way. And that's the one restriction or the constraint we have. We need more drivers. But as long as we get them, the funding is there, the organisation is there to make it happen. And further steps, people start to see it now. Bus stops going up so that people can see this new Connecting Ireland service right across the country as something that everyone can use. It's good value, connects to other public transport routes, connects to work and to school. So if we get the drivers, we're going to provide the service.
Anne Graham, the Chief Executive of the National Transport Authority, says there's a plan in place to convert all public transport to electric vehicles.
So we've got an objective to move all public transport to being electric, but we're testing out some services with electric buses in our cities first, but it will be moving to these local link routes as well. But we just need to test, can the battery serve, you know, the distance that are travelled on local link services, what are the charges? We need to get charging infrastructure in place as well. So there's a bit of work to be done, but that's our ambition, is to have all our subsidised public transport being operated by zero emission buses.
The Green Party leader says the government wants to invest in rural transport and plans to make it more affordable and more accessible.
I think we didn't have the money, and I think that's what's changed. The programme for government commits two to one public investment in public transport. And it's that political will, I think, has allowed us to start planning all these sort of routes. Now, it's still a real challenge. We've a lot of money on public service systems, but it's working. We reduced fares last year by 20%. we're an outlier now internationally. The numbers have come back in Ireland the way they haven't elsewhere. So the people have responded, particularly with those lower fares and greater frequency. I don't know, maybe we just didn't see it as people thought, sure, people would never use that. But actually, when you provide good quality public transport, the Irish people flock to it. And that's what's happening at the moment.
Eamon Ryan in Tullamore last week launching the Connecting Ireland Rural Mobility Plan. And I think an answer to a question that more than one person is sending in to me at the moment is that the state didn't have the money. That's what he's saying. I was there myself and asked him why it was that we were a step behind in terms of connecting rural Ireland when Eamon Ryan is telling us that we're taking a great step forward with this plan. And he said that the money wasn't there. Hilda has messaged in to ask why he sat idly by while Bus Éireann cut so many national routes. And obviously there is a fair point in that regard. He was also asked at that a launch as to why he would be travelling around the world on a plane for St. Patrick's Day, as all the ministers do tend to. And Eamon Ryan said, ultimately, it's good value for emissions, as it were. So if you're going to emit, then get over when you can really ramp up the soft power, which Ireland is so famous for being able to ramp up. What services do you think are lacking around your area in terms of transport? If you're somewhere where you think you're under-provisioned, message in and we'll give you a shout out. And of course, the calls to which you'd like to attach your name.
The Monday Sports Review, with thanks to Slater Kia Mullingar. Kia, main dealers for Westmeath and Longford. See slaterkia.ie.
Yeah, we're going to be looking forward. I keep on calling it looking forward. I beg your pardon. We're going to be looking back over the sporting weekend. Before that, I just want to flag for you an interesting discussion we'll be having within the hour as well regarding deer numbers in the Midlands and the havoc that they're wreaking on the roads. Stay tuned for that. We're going to now pivot back to the weekend sport. And it was a big and bumper weekend of sport. And no better man to talk us through it than the producer of The Inside Line, which is, of course, every Sunday from 2 o'clock at Will O'Callaghan, aptly supported and enabled by Stephen Bradley. Stephen, how's the form?
Not too bad, sir, Mr. Hollywood. You enjoyed the big chair this morning.
It definitely comes with its downsides, but everyone's been great in getting in touch with us and driving the show on, so it's been enjoyable thus far. You're very good to ask. Let's move on to the sporting weekend that was. And there's only one place to start, I suppose. It is in the Allianz National Football League third division, and that's the Midlands Derby. There was one in Division 4 that we'll get on to, but Westmeath took on Offaly in Mullingar. How did that go?
It was a good game. Like I said, it was a game that Westmeath came out on top. After it was very evenly contested. I mean, Offaly have been struggling lately to put together good offensive performances, but they've been okay off the ball, and that showed yesterday. You know, like they conceded a penalty 3 minutes into the game for a foul inside the parallelogram, and Westmeath scored the penalty, but they only conceded two more points after that in the whole of the first half. They played very well defensively. It's getting the ball over the bar and into the net themselves has been the problem. They scored 7 points in the first half and then only 5 in the second. And it's going to be interesting to see how they react and how they get forward with that. But Westmeath have the opposite problem. Westmeath 2 weeks ago against Longford scored, you know, 8 points before the first half and 4-8 after it. You know, same happened today. Same happened yesterday, I should say. It's going 1-2 in the first half and 1-10 in the second. Like, they only played 30. If they turned up for matches 35 minutes late and played the second half, they'd be brilliant. You know, so it's going to be interesting to see how both teams adapt on this, because Westmeath were brilliant in the second half. They were far more potent, but they did have a tailwind.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really until the 60th minute, 61st minute, where Westmeath actually took the lead. Like, Offaly were still able to just to keep a lid on the game and keep it close. And, you know, it was Kieran Martin who came off the bench in the 49th minute. He scored the goal, a fisted effort that got in and nearly scored a second goal straight afterwards, only the crossbar stopping him. If it wasn't for that, and like I said, they knocked on a couple of late points at the end. It's a 6-point win on the scoreboard, but Offaly didn't deserve to lose by 6. They probably only deserved to lose by 1 or 2. And, you know, Desi Dolan after the game, he was saying the same thing, where it was like, you know, Offaly were better than what they showed. It's just going to be interesting to see what happens after this and how Offaly adapt.
Yeah, let's hear from Desi Dolan now, speaking after the game.
I think we have to factor in the conditions. Like, there's a very strong breeze there, and just when we were doing the warm-up, you could realise that you couldn't really score much past 20 yards in a day like that. So I suppose while people and players might be frustrated, the conditions do lend itself to making it very difficult to score. And Offaly had 14 men behind the ball as well, so when you have to break that down, it's not easy. So it took us a while to get to grips with it, and I suppose there was plenty of times when you'd be frustrated, but ultimately the lads dug deep, showed great heart and came out, showed that bit of class and bit of composure in the end, got the goals and ultimately got the result.
You got a great start. Jack Smith made a great run up the field, got in, fouled for the penalty, I suppose cost him probably the injury as well, but John put it away, and that was a huge start against the breeze.
Yeah, it was, but similar to the Longford game, we probably went 20 minutes there. We had opportunities to score and we didn't convert enough, I would say. So that's an area that we'll have to work on. And there's always, the thing about it is, this time of the year with the conditions and underfoot conditions, like the pitches aren't dry. Like, there is plenty of mistakes. And ultimately, I think we made a couple of errors with our shot selection, and there was a couple of points that we didn't take that could have put us in a very good position at half time. But equally, at half time, there was a strong breeze. There was 2 points in it. It was only a matter of pushing on, and maybe it, like what Offaly did to us, they push up in the kickouts. I suppose that tactic was working well today because of the wind that was in it.
Offaly started great in the second half. Two more points. There were four up inside the 5 or 6 minutes of the second half. Yeah, getting worried at that.
Ah, I was, Jerry, to be honest. Like, I have to go to school in the morning, look at the tub of students and all of that. That's my boss's Tom Lowry. And just on that, I just mentioned it. Like, the students last week lost, but I thought our school team was excellent in the final against Naas. But we've some awfully students there, and my boss is obviously Tom Lowry. But no, like, there's always that bit of rivalry, and they did come out with a great, you know, spirit, and that's what you'd expect from them. I think Liam Kearns has done a great job as well. They really are playing well, and it took all our might to deal with the opposition today, but eventually we did. And
yeah, that was Desi Dolan there. And Stephen, I suppose, just based on his comments towards the end there, in deference to Liam Kearns and Offaly, the definition of a healthy rivalry between these two counties.
Yeah, and both teams are on the up. Like, let's make this clear. Offaly are playing better than they were last year. And it's a case of their defence being excellent. It's just, can they find someone who will score them 6 points a game? That's the next step for their evolution. We know that Westmeath are a good attacking side. They showed it when winning the Talton Cup last year. It's, can they play for 70 minutes? Like, this is going to be the key now for Westmeath going forward, whether they can maintain these second half performances and stretch them out to being 50 minute performances to 55 minute performances, because promotion is on. Like you look at the league table, both teams now are on 4 points after three games. You know, it's only Cavan who are three wins out of three, and Offaly play Cavan next Sunday. So that game live 2 p.m. on Midlands 103, of course, but it's, if Offaly can win that, like, it's a long jump at the top. Westmeath go to Newry to play down on Saturday at 6. They win that, they could be top of the table. So getting into Division 2, getting into Sam Maguire, there's no reason why both teams can't look at that game yesterday and think that they both get in, because there's no, like I said, there's no real class above them. Like I said, Cavanagh 3 wins out 3, but if Offaly can defend like they did a couple of weeks ago, like they did yesterday for at least 50 minutes. If they could do that for 70 and just get a couple of more points from somewhere, they could beat Cavan. So, like I said, both teams' promotion hopes are far from over. If anything, yesterday's game made it clear that they are probably two of the best four sides in the division.
Yeah, it's a division full of good counties, not necessarily the greats that you'll end up coming against in Division 2 and 1. And by great, I obviously mean in terms of size and resource and that type of thing. But it's a good competitive division, Division 3. Looking forward to seeing how Westmeath and Offaly make out there. The other scorers in that third division, Antrim were 119 to 14 point winners over Tipperary. Fermanagh 214, Dow 310. Cavan, as you said there, Stephen, beat Longford to look destined for Division 4. Unless they can turn things around early doors. They've had a bad start to the season, despite a very strong World Cup opener. I think they pumped Laois a few weeks back. Cavan 119, Longford 11 points. What about Laois though? They're in Division 4. It feels like, though, they might not be for much longer. 117 to 28 winners. I'll run through the rest of the Division 4 scores, Stephen, and you can then catch us up on Laois. Wicklow, 116, beat London, who got 1-9. Sligo, comfortable winners over Waterford, 21 points to 12 points. And Wexford were 19 points to Leitrim's 15. Leitrim had been doing very well up until that stage. But Laois, they've got a 100% record and they do top the standings, Stephen.
If, like I said, if you were to look at it just like that, you'd think Laois should be delighted with it. You know, 3 wins from 3, come from behind victory against Carlow, away from home, tricky place to play, Dr. Cullen Park, as it always is, scoring 117 and having 2 lads sent off at the end of the game and still managing to see the game out. You'd think it'd be comfortable. But wait till you hear Billy Sheehan in a minute. He's far from happy with the way they were playing. They didn't score for the first 20 minutes of the game. You know, like that. Never mind awfully and Westmeath's poor starts. Laois were shocking for 20 minutes. Like, couldn't get the ball near the goal. And it was only the fact that Carlow didn't score for the first 15 minutes themselves. Well, like, we were all, it was like watching a soccer match. It was, you know, listening to Patrick Sullivan said it was 0-0 after a quarter of an hour. It's like, is the World Cup on? Like, but finally, Laois, finally, they got into their stride. They started knocking over points again. Paul Kingston getting goals as he does. It's just waiting for Laois to put that performance together where they, again, they play well for 70 minutes. You know, today or yesterday, they couldn't keep the ball. You know, it was giving away the ball again and again. You know, long passes going astray, short hand passes going astray. It was just sloppy. And like I said, it was only really into the second half where, you know, Carlos, they scored, it was even at half time. Carlos scored 1-2 to start the second half. And you were thinking Carlos were going to run away with it. But that's when Leash's quality told. You know, they finally imprinted themselves on the game. Carlow only scored 1 more point in 27 minutes of play. And that was in the last minute after the red cards. You know, like, Laois were very impressive for half an hour. They were far from it for 40 minutes. And the thing is now, can Laois put together again that performance for 50 or 60? Because they're top of Division 4. They should, yes, they're going to miss Everton O'Connell next week. But they should beat Wicklow Saturday evening. If they do that, it's 4 wins out of 4. And their last 2 games are Waterford at home and London away. And neither of those sides have won a game yet. So, like I said, you look at it from the outside, 3 wins from 3, 9-point win, happy days. But as we'll hear from Billy Sheehan, he is not happy about it at all.
No, and it's that search for consistency at this early stage of the season that they all seem to be struggling with. Let's get the thoughts of Billy Sheehan, who caught up with Pat O'Sullivan after their win over Carlow.
Very lucky to get the result. Thought Carlow possibly a better team. They should have been further ahead in the first half. You don't score for 20 minutes in the first half, you don't deserve to win many games.
And so you had to regroup your team at half time. Obviously you were hugely disappointed 20 minutes without a score, and then you reached a point and Carlow had got 1-2 and probably missed a few scores, maybe even to go 1-5 or 1-6 ahead. You must have had a certain talking to at half time.
No, these are good lads. We discussed where we were going wrong. There was no big roaring or shouting. There was one player kind of kept us in the game, and we were very lucky he was in form. Bar that, performances all over the field weren't up to the level, and the boys know that. Like, there's no point me saying that people watched the game here today and it wasn't good enough. One team brought intensity, one team didn't. That's the simple maths of the matter, and I can say no more than that. Yeah, Carlow had a great goal chance, you know, from Wider. Scott saved it, so we had our chances as well. Like, you know, we had opportunities of creating goal chances, but again, hand pass has gone astray, kick pass has gone astray, balls dropped. Carlow are the better team. Carlow should have been further ahead. And some days you're a bit lucky, and that's what we were today.
3 games only about 6 points, and you face into next weekend Wicklow team coming strong and possible with a couple of players down from red cards that you certainly wouldn't be happy with.
And look, the fellas get red cards, or the fellas in the panel just got to come in and play. Wicklow were very good yesterday. They beat us in the championship last year. They've no fear of us, and I'm sure it's a situation is with or without the suspended players. We'll see where we're at. And watching them next against London, and if I presume Oisín McConville was here today, he won't have any fear coming to Port Laois.
I do enjoy Billy Sheehan's post-match interviews. He really paints a compelling picture, and it's rarely positive, but obviously by the sounds of it, Stephen, he had merit to be annoyed there. Let's look at the National Ladies Football League. The Division 2 counties, of course, Laois and Westmeath, they were in action against Tipperary for Laois and Roscommon for Westmeath, respectively. How did they get on?
2 wins. And like I said, Laois had a great win over unbeaten Tipperary, 112 to 3-5. And it's one of those performances that just gives you hope for Leash that they can put together again a little bit of a run, get them out of Division 2, get them back to where they should be in Division 1. Westmeath following behind. You know, they're 3 points behind in fifth, but again, another good win over Roscommon side that would have beaten them last year. So it's just one of those ones where you want to build momentum, you want to get through these league situations and build confidence. And both teams have done fantastically like that. Unfortunately, in National Ladies Football League Division 3, Offaly lost by a point to Clare, the heartbreaker. And that's now 4 defeats in 4 for Offaly. Like it's the opposite problem. Like they can't buy a win. You know, like they're playing well. It's just getting to late situations. They're conceding late points, they're conceding late goals, and the bottom of the table with Sligo now on 0 points out of 4. So contrasting fortunes for the ladies' teams right now. You look at Leash, you look at Westmeath, and you're thinking Westmeath with a little bit of luck might get into a promotion scenario. Leash with a little bit of luck might win the division. Offaly, however, just need to buy a just they can't buy a win from anywhere right now, unfortunately.
No, they can't get that momentum going. It's so tricky. And of course, Leash coming off a high from last year looking like they're keeping the legs moving in that respect. We got the Camogie season up and running over the weekend as well. The very Ireland International Camogie Leagues. Division 1B, Offaly were in action against Waterford. And then in 2A, Westmeath played Kerry and Leash were against Meath. Talk us through what happened on weekend number one for the National Camogie Leagues.
I'll let the scoreboard talk for the Offaly game. Offaly 1-9, Waterford 4-22.
Not great.
What do you say? Yeah, it's just one of those games where it's like nothing went right for them. Like Waterford started off, they are a far better side. Waterford could win the All-Ireland. And it's one of those ones where it's like you take your licking and you go, right, okay, that's it. We're not going to beat this team. We'll move on. Getting that experience, playing a team that is better than you just have to almost sit there and take the experience from it. Meanwhile, in Division 2A, Westmeath got a very decent draw at Kerry. Frankly, 1-6 to 9 points. And Leash, just like the Offaly lady footballer, lost a heartbreaker to Meath by a point. It's one of those ones where day one, you're like, okay, let's just see if we can get points on the board, get a win on the board. Offaly will be looking past that Waterford game and almost looking to start their season from scratch next week. Westmeath and Leash will be very encouraged by decent performances that shows that they are going to be competitive in a division that they would probably hope to get out of, frankly.
Yeah, the Camogie season now up and running, so we'll be keeping an eye on it as the fixtures come thick and fast, along with the Lidl National Ladies Football League and, of course, the men's hurling and football. It was a busy weekend of Premier League action, and the first game of the weekend was potentially, certainly looking like the most affecting of the title narrative. Let's check in with Mikel Arteta, the Arsenal manager. He reckons his players have more belief than ever after a 4-2 victory against Aston Villa sent them back to the top of the league. They twice came from behind and they got the last two goals in the last couple of minutes of injury time. Arteta says they finally got the results that their efforts deserve.
Against Brentford, we made it to win the game. We didn't win it because of a decision. Fine. Against Manchester City, we deserve it more with the performance, but the reality in football in the boxes, the games are decided. And today we have to put something else and still a lot of things to improve. And we have to be humble enough to see those things, recognize them, work on them.
Stephen, what about that then? They have to be humble enough to recognise the things that they need to improve upon. Naturally, they've got to find a way of not playing like they did for large portions of that game against Aston Villa.
But they won. And like, if it was any other team, we'd say it was the performance of champions. You know, not playing well, struggling through, and then in the 93rd minute, pulling a goal out of their backside. Like, it's listening to Unai Emery give out about Emi Martinez going up to try and score an equaliser at 2-3 and said he'd rather lose 2-3 than 2-4 shows the mentality of Emery's Villa right now. But if Martinez wasn't time-wasting all game, there wouldn't have been time for the ball to hit the crossbar and then the back of his head and go into the net to make Arsenal go 3-2 up. It's a mad race. Like you said, with Arsenal then going, you know, 2 points clear of Manchester, 3 points clear of Manchester City, and then Manchester City only managing to get a draw, Nottingham Forest. You know, Erling Haaland missing two glorious chances from 5 yards out. Phil Foden messing up a 2-on-1. Nottingham Forest scoring with their only shot on target. It's getting to the stage where as soon as we think the script is written, the Premier League just picks up that script, throws it out the window and writes a new one. We've no idea what's going to happen next. And we're probably, considering the last 4 or 5 years, we've been handled title races that have, between Manchester, you know, City and Liverpool, have been milquetoast and lukewarm at best. This season is just bad, and I'm all here for it.
That's compelling. There's no question about that. And it's enhanced as well, as you said there, by City's vulnerability, by Arsenal's the novelty of Arsenal being as good as they have been, but also the resurgence of Manchester United. Erik ten Hag, I saw a Manchester United social post that simply stated with a favourable picture of him, let's say, saying this man is a genius. Now, that seems excessive, but he's improved things from top to bottom in the club in a short space of time. Would that be fair to say?
Yep, and he's made a couple of big decisions, and all of them have gone right. You know, he's dropped Harry Maguire. They're playing better defensively. He dropped Cristiano Ronaldo. He's now in Saudi Arabia. Like, it's every decision he's had to make has gone right, and even his development of players is starting to show. Marcus Rashford is a different player from the World Cup. You know, he's played 10 games for United in the Premier League since the World Cup. He scored 10 goals. Bruno Fernandes is now playing right midfield and is creating room for Wout Weghorst to play almost as a centre-attacking midfielder instead of a striker. And they're just knocking the ball around better. They're getting the ball quicker to Rashford, which is leaving him more space and more time to find those shots that he needs and those goal opportunities that he needs to help Manchester United succeed. It's just, can they keep this up? They've the small matter of Barcelona on Thursday night and then a cup final on Sunday. Like, they've so many games coming up. And it's a case of, can they keep that momentum? Can they keep building on it? Because they played so well against Barcelona on Thursday night. Like, Barcelona have conceded 7 goals in La Liga all year. Like, all, like, season. Never mind the year.
Yeah.
And United scored 2 of them in New Camp and scored and had 2 penalties turned down. They're probably going to score 3 or 4 more on Thursday. And then they get a cup final against Newcastle, who are going to be playing Lawrence Karius in goal.
Well, you've brought us on to the next point. Obviously, a huge game coming up at the weekend between Manchester United and Newcastle United. And Newcastle's form has fallen off the floor at the worst possible time. And then, of course, he had Nick Pope with his attempted interception outside the box. Just an awful moment to witness, and the straight red card kicks him out of the final, which is super harsh. Is good result for Liverpool. Firstly, before we get on to like the League Cup final or anything like that, what about the race for the top four? Because, you know, Liverpool beating Newcastle in that narrative specifically is not nothing. If Liverpool go on a run, do you think they could chase them down and the rest of the teams ahead of them?
You would expect them to, but Liverpool have the small matter of Real Madrid at home tomorrow night. Like, they're another team searching for that momentum, searching for those 3 or 4 wins on the bounce, just to give them a bit of an energy injection, just to give them a confidence boost to say, okay, we're back. And Liverpool's problem all year has been they'll win 2 and then they'll lose 2. Then they'll win 2 and lose 2. Well, they've just won 2 and now the European champions are turning up. As for Spurs, they're missing Bentancur badly, and they were decent for large portions of the game against West Ham yesterday. But when you're relying on Emerson Royale and Ben Davies to be your best attackers, there's something wrong. So Newcastle should have spent on another big midfielder. They should have given someone to play beside Bruno Guimaraes and help them get over the line and get to fourth, so that then the Saudi investment fund can open their checkbook and spend big. They didn't. And now they're 3 points ahead of Liverpool, and Liverpool have a game in hand. It's going to be tight. And if you were going to back any of them, you'd back Liverpool's experience in the fact that they know how to close out races. Newcastle haven't been here for years, and well, Tottenham are Tottenham.
Let's leave the Premier League there. I'm going to ask you to briefly run me through how the Midlands Derby got on in the opening weekend of the League of Ireland. In the First Division, of course, neither side want to be, but Longford Town and Athlone Town were in action in Longford.
They were, and it was Athlone Town who came out in victors. A big crowd at Longford, 1,400 turned up for the first game of the season. Cracking crowds all round in the League of Ireland at the start of the season. You know, Kerry FC got 1,400 for their first game. There seems to be a lot more interest and a lot more people going to games now this year, which is fantastic. And Athlone Town put together a fantastic second half performance. 2 goals from Franz Piero and a header from Jamar Campion-Hines helped them to a winning start. However, Piero will miss their next game because he got a second yellow for taking off his shirt while celebrating.
Oh, that's what got him sent off.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, that, I'd say Dermot Lennon and the backroom team are not thrilled with him on that instance.
No, but it's just one of those silly rules that was brought in for the Premier League because totally people ridiculous. Were having different slogans on their shirts. Like, it's one of those rules where it's like, yeah, you can put it on TV games, but for the League of Ireland First Division, it's not needed. Let the man cheer his goal.
And he gets his marching orders. Our coverage of Longford Town against Athlone Town is with thanks to Munnally Opticians, Monksland Athlone, celebrating 15 years in business. For more, see munnallyopticians.ie. For more from Stephen Bradley, see The Inside Line on Sundays. Stephen, we're going to look forward to getting your perspective on, for instance, that League Cup final with Will on Sunday. Until then, thanks for taking the time today and have a good week.
No problem at all, sir.
That was Stephen Bradley running us through this weekend's sport. You are very welcome back as he scrambles back onto the desk, onto the chair, puts the headphones on and starts speaking again. Apologies for that. Sometimes things can get a bit complicated. Now we're looking at an issue that is quite unusual in a sense. There's been a call for additional signage to warn motorists about deer crossing on a leash road. I'm very glad to say that a local representative, Fine Gael's councillor for Laois County Council, and the Las Cathaoirleach of Laois County Council, PJ Kelly, is joining us to look at this issue. PJ, thanks for taking the call. Talk me through where this is happening and what is exactly happening.
Hello there. It's a stretch of road there between the what we use locally as the old Montague Hotel on the Dublin Cork Limerick Road and Bally British Village. The forestry there straddles both sides of the road there. It would be always known locally as a deer pass anyway, but I suppose since the motorway went in now, there's a high fence gone along the motorway to protect that from deer crossing, but the deer get trapped then, I suppose, or they kind of stay around that area between the old Dublin Road and the motorway. So over the Christmas period there, there was 3 deer hit and killed. And I suppose it's to warn motorists there, it's a dark stretch of road and it's a straight stretch. And like they can do fair damage to a car when you hit them. But apart from that then as well, just one lady spoke to me about it and said that they come on it themselves, and herself and her daughter, and they had to pull one deer in off the road that was, you know, whose back was broken.
That's horrendous.
And that deer had to be humanely, you know, put down on account of it. But it's traumatic for, you know, people, you know, especially someone so young come, seeing such a lovely animal in distress like that. But it would be a known area, like, and the population of deer has increased a lot. I was just going to ask you,
do we have a developing problem in that regard? It seems like this is not the first instance where there's an area or a zone that where maybe deer had been known to be about. It's gone from that to being a far more prevalent issue. The numbers of deer across the country seem to be shooting up.
Yeah, they are, and like the Phoenix Park in Dublin is a pure example of that. Like if you go up there, my own friend, we were up there a few weeks ago at Dublin Zoo, and you can just see hundreds of them just congregating, and people are actually hand feeding them. That they've almost become pets, like for what would be considered wild animals. And I suppose when they're, I suppose, sheltered in that area of the Phoenix Park, they're not going to be wild anymore, because there's going to be, you know, a degree of inbreeding in them as well, and they're going to become very tame. And it's nearly, in the countryside, it's a bit, you know, they're more open, I suppose, and they're wilder, but the population has increased, but there's no way of culling them, you know, to a certain degree. I know the figures are out there where they have taken out certain amounts of them, but the population of them is so serious now that, like, I know of some farmers now who are having fields of grass or barley grazed to the clay in some cases. You know, like, deer are no different than any other bovine. They'll graze, and most of it is done at night time, I suppose, or in very early in the morning. You just see the large numbers, but it's something that's going to have to be dealt with in the very near future anyway.
What can the local authority do from your perspective at the moment?
Well, I know some people saying that stretch of road have spoken about maybe fencing that area, but like, deer being deer, when there's a certain area fenced off, they'll just move along the fence and they'll cross it at some other point. And when there's no fence, they cross it, I suppose, sporadically. But if there's a fence up, they all cross at the one, you know, at the one area or the one point, and you're going to have a lot more serious accidents then. But it's hard to know at the moment. I suppose culling them is the short answer, really. But it's how they can, I suppose, get the manpower to do that job.
Yeah, it's very complicated by the sounds of it. And of course, we've heard of the likes of potentially reintroducing wolves to the island. That seems like maybe a dramatic long-term measure to take. I do understand, however, signage will be posted in and around the black spots for this issue in Laois at the moment. Or that's something that the council's working on, am I right?
Yeah, they are, and they've actually put up some of the poles there now. And even the last day or two, just before the weekend, there the signs went up. And I know you suggested about maybe reintroducing wolves, but the unfortunately about wolves is they won't know the difference between a deer, a sheep, or a cow, or a heifer, or a calf. So I wouldn't consider that to be a great idea. You know, wolves, they don't generally pick and choose as to which one they'll take. So to me, that wouldn't be, you know, wouldn't be advisable. But the signage is going up, and I suppose that's the best they can do at the moment. And just for people, when they know that area is prone for deer crossing, it's just to slow down that little bit more. Like, deer just spring across the road. They don't, and if they get dazzled by the lights, they'll stand. But otherwise, they'll spring across the road. But just for people to be more careful on that particular stretch when they see those deer signs, just to pull back a little bit, especially during the night time when they won't see anything coming, only at the last second.
Yeah, and well, look, that's all we can do today is to warn people to be conscious and aware of it. And other than that, to keep an eye on the signage, and hopefully this is an issue that can be gotten on top of. PJ, thanks for taking the call off us this morning. Have a good afternoon and a good week.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks very much, and thank you.
That's PJ Kelly, Cahirlock, of Laois County Council and Fine Gael councillor. We have a winner of the competition. Maria Sheehan from Port Laois is today's winner. She's guaranteed a meal for two, and it may be upgraded at the end of the week. Go to midlands103.com to the win section there to get involved in the competition for tomorrow. We are counting down to heading to the newsroom, and very shortly after that, the man himself, Carl James, will be bringing you what I like to call 3 hours of absolute bangers. That is Carl's afternoon show, and he tends to play some cracking music, so you can look forward to that. For the moment though, for myself, David Hollywood, you've been very good to be listening to us throughout the morning. We've got Will Faulkner back in the seat tomorrow, and for myself, have a good afternoon and a good week to yourself.